Review from last time. We talked about government under a constitution as the higher authority, as the highest authority. That is, through the history of the world, sometimes there have been kings or monarchs who have been the highest authority. Sometimes there have been dictators who have taken power by force. But the United States set up a different system of government where the highest authority wouldn't be a person or a group, but the highest authority would be a document, the Constitution. And so rather than the king being on top and making the laws as he pleased, we have the Constitution on the top, and the people and the laws of the nation are subject to the Constitution. It seemed to me that there are similarities between that and the government of ancient Israel, where God put his own law above the kings and the prophets and the priests, and the kings had to rule according to the law. And the judges in Israel had to judge according to the law that was given. They weren't to make up their own ideas of who should win or lose in a certain case. They should judge according to the law of God, and they shouldn't change it. But they should have a law external to themselves. And so we had some diagrams about that. The bottom of page one, the essential role of judges was to judge according to a law external to themselves. Judges couldn't invent new laws. They had to rule according to what the law said, the law that God had given. And then number two, judges shouldn't take bribes. That would be using another basis for judgment than the established law, and I gave some diagrams there. And so it seemed to me that in the United States, the system that was set up was similar to that. Judges were to judge according to established law. That was the basis for judgment, and they were to judge the laws or the cases according to the Constitution. In the United States, we have a district court. This is at the United States federal level of courts. We have district courts, 100 and some of those. And then appeals courts. There are 12 circuit courts of appeals in the United States. And then we have the Supreme Court. So that's the way it was supposed to go. But gradually, it happened that the judges began to realize that they could invent new ideas of things that they thought should be right that weren't in the Constitution, but that they thought should be enacted. And then they would say, oh, here, we find this in the Constitution, and they would, in a way, invent new laws that weren't literally in the Constitution as it was written, but were their new ideas of what should be done. And so a different system of ruling came about. And we talked last week at some length about the Roe versus Wade decision in 1973, where in this paragraph, the Supreme Court found a right for a woman to have an abortion and take the life of her unborn child. Now, where do you see abortion here in the 14th Amendment? Nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. And they said, well, it looks to us here that says that a woman has a right to have an abortion, and the state can't, and the government can't outlaw that. You don't see it there? Well, not surprising. In 1868, when that amendment was passed, there were laws in many, many states prohibiting abortion. And nobody at that time thought that the meaning of the words at that time said anything about abortion. Oh, but someone might say, well, we're defining liberty to mean the liberty to have an abortion. And my answer is that, well, your job as a judge is to define the meanings of the words, but you're not free to define liberty in a way far different from what the original authors of this amendment thought it meant. And the states that passed that amendment didn't think it meant freedom to have an abortion because they kept all their laws against abortion, and so did all 50 states, in terms of restrictions on abortion in subsequent times. But the Supreme Court just said, oh, now we've got a new meaning for this word liberty, or this meaning of this phrase due process of law, and it allows us to say that basically at any point in pregnancy a woman can take the life of her unborn child if she wishes. And so the system was not the judges judging according to the Constitution and judging the law, but they had a new basis for judgment. It was the Constitution plus their idea of what is good. What is good? Oh, I think we have a new idea that's good. people should have the right to an abortion. And so we'll just say that's part of the Constitution. And nobody has the power to disagree. And that's where we stand today, since 1973. Now I want to go on to point two on page three of your outline. Point number two. The Supreme Court thus became the most powerful group in the nation. I'd argued that the government was set up with a separation of powers to prevent against the abuse of power. It seemed to me that was parallel to the separation of powers in prophet, priest, and king in the Old Testament, separation of powers in plural apostles in the New Testament, plural elders in New Testament churches. When God established governing structures, there was a dispersal of power, so there wasn't any one ultimate person over the whole country. But here, the Supreme Court becomes really violates this principle of separation of powers because it becomes more powerful than the legislative and executive branches and basically is telling everybody else what to do. So here are some other examples of how the Supreme Court has made some changes. Look at the First Amendment to the Constitution. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Now, when that was first passed, 1789, the Constitution was established? I believe that's right. It basically meant there shouldn't be an established church. They're not going to make the Episcopal Church the official church of the whole nation. They're not going to make the Congregational Church the official church, or the Catholic Church the whole church, the official church. It didn't mean there shouldn't be any public expression of religious viewpoints in the country. It didn't mean that government officials couldn't pray. It didn't mean there couldn't be Ten Commandments posted different places. It didn't have anything to do with that. It just said no established church, no establishment of religion. But in 1971, in the decision Lemon v. Kurtzman, the Supreme Court decided that a government action, quote, must not have the primary effect of either advancing or inhibiting religion. That was remarkable, 1971. It isn't any longer saying we can't establish an official church for the whole country. It's saying no government action can advance religion, generally. That wasn't what the authors said. That wasn't what the amendment said. But they said, well, they basically were telling us there's a sense to the phrase establishment of religion that wasn't in the minds of the founders, wasn't in the minds of the authors. But now we're saying that it's there, so it is there. What's the result? The Supreme Court decided that government could no longer favor any religion at all. That meant it began to exclude religious speech from more and more areas of life. Public monuments, where Ten Commandments were taken down, the cross is taken out of city seals or state seals and state symbols. Prayer isn't any longer allowed at school events. Not even a moment of silence for students in public schools. And they're all challenges to people opening a city council meeting with prayer and all of this kind of thing, again and again and again. All that came, this is the important part, this didn't come because any Congress passed a law saying you can't have crosses on city seals. No Congress or legislature in any state passed a law saying you can't open a city council meeting with prayer. People in the United States never voted on this. It's just the nine justices of the Supreme Court said, hey, we're making a new rule. You can't do this anymore. Well, what authority did they have to do that? They didn't have authority in the original meaning of the First Amendment. No, rather, it was they're no longer judging by the Constitution, but they're judging according to the Constitution plus their new ideas of what is good. Is that making sense? So all these controversies come out of Lemon v. Kurtzman and similar decisions, but it wasn't passed by any elected official. Now look, you may think it's good or not to have a city council meeting open with prayer. You're free to voice your opinion and have your opinion about that. But that decision should be made by the city council, not by the Supreme Court sitting off in Washington, D.C., legislating this for the whole country. Am I making sense? And the First Amendment, in fact, says there shouldn't be any law prohibiting the free exercise thereof. That is, prohibiting the free exercise of religion. Well, can't someone in a city council meeting decide that he wants to give a prayer, or someone at the beginning of a football game? What's wrong, in fact, with the free exercise of religion? A Roman Catholic priest, a Jewish rabbi, a Scottsdale Bible Church pastor opening a football game with a moment of prayer? I think that protects free exercise of religion. And it, in fact, prevents, has a positive role of showing that there's a diversity of religion allowed and protected in our country. So I would argue that there's benefit to that. Now, you may disagree, but then we can vote on it. And then the course of the nation is determined by the votes of the people or by their elected representatives. That's a decision for people to make, not for the court, it seems to me. The exclusion of religion from the public square also meant that schools are now prohibited from teaching the most basic fact in the whole universe, and that is that God created it. Why can't schools teach that anymore? Because of Lemon v. Kurtzman. The Supreme Court just said, we're going to rule that out. When I was growing up in school, people could talk about God. People could talk about God creating things. People could talk about God's moral standards. Teachers could talk about these things. There wasn't anything in the laws or the Constitution that prohibited that, but all of a sudden the Supreme Court just ruled it out. And teachers are prevented from teaching that God exists. Even though 90% of the population of the United States believes that God exists. Well, Supreme Court says, 90% of the people might believe something, but it doesn't make any difference to us. We're going to tell you, you can't say it. And it also means that the teaching that there are moral standards and there is a God who holds people accountable for moral standards can't be even mentioned or taught in public schools as something you believe. Could be mentioned historically as something that people used to believe or something like that, a historical fact, but not as something that we ourselves want students to believe. What has happened to the moral decline of the society? What has happened to the behavior and disciplinary standards and everything of students in our schools? Well, doesn't that have a lot to do with the exclusion of a sense of accountability to God in school? But that's just stemming from the Supreme Court overreaching and saying something that the First Amendment never intended. All right, that's one. Is this making sense? This is where it all comes from. This is, you say there's so much wrong with our society. The root of it is here. And there's nothing that anybody can do about it. 100% of the people in the United States could vote in a national election, say, we want teachers to teach that there is a God and that the universe was created by God and that he has moral standards. It wouldn't make any difference. It couldn't become law because the Supreme Court would say, sorry, it's unconstitutional. And we would say, wait a minute, that's not what the First Amendment meant. And they would say, we tell you that's what the First Amendment means, so that's what it means. And you have no ability to change it. All of Congress could, by 100%, try to pass a law to change this. It wouldn't make any difference. The Supreme Court has the ultimate power. Here's another example. This is a different area. The Fifth Amendment says, nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation. Now, this amendment, through the history of the legal system, has been taken to say there is an assumption, right in the Constitution, there is an assumption that the government has the right to take your land for public use. But there's a distinction between private property and public use. What's public use? That means you want to build Highway 101 and somebody's got a farm in the way. You can take it, but you have to pay. So Alan here, you know, we want a road to go straight. And Alan says, no, I'm not going to sell my farm. I've lived here forever. And the city or the state can say, sorry, Alan, we're taking your land and we'll give you, you know, kind of a fair evaluation for it and you're out. The state has to be able to do that if it wants to build straight roads or if it wants to build a military base or other things that are of a public building or public facility. And historically, there was always a difference, public-private. But never could you take Alan's land and give it to Scott because Scott's another private landholder and he wants to build a shopping center. Okay? until 2005 in its decision, Kelo versus City of New London in Connecticut, by a 5-4 decision, Justice Kennedy sided with the more liberal judges. The court decided that the City of New London could take Suzette Kelo's house for an urban redevelopment plan carried out by Scott, a private developer. And they said public use doesn't just mean roads and army bases and courthouses and things like that. It also means a public purpose of cleaning up the city. So a private land was taken for private use for the first time. And a huge outcry arose among the people of the country in 2005. And here's the dissent by Justice Clarence Thomas, or Justice O'Connor, Sandra Day O'Connor wrote, "Any property may now be taken for the benefit of another private party. But the fallout from this decision will not be random. The beneficiaries are those citizens with disproportionate influence and power in the political process, including large corporations and development firms." So you've got friends on Scottsdale City Council, and they can decide that Barry has a house that they want to put a shopping center on, and Scottsdale City Council can just say, "Barry, sorry, we've got somebody's developing it." So Senator O'Connor was really troubled by this, and Justice Thomas said, "If such economic development takings are for public use, then any taking is for public use." And the court has erased the public use clause from our Constitution. "I do not believe this court can eliminate liberties expressly enumerated in the Constitution. Today's decision is simply the latest in a string of cases construing the public use clause to be a virtual nullity without the slightest nod to its original meaning." Catch that? Original meaning. Saying that's not what it meant. "In my view, the public use clause originally understood is a meaningful limit on government's eminent domain power." But the five justices decided it was a good idea if government had such power, so they just told the nation that was the new meaning of the Constitution, and the matter was settled, and there's nothing you can do about it. Another case that was troubling, it came out right, but it came out right by a 5-4 decision. James Dale was an assistant scoutmaster in New Jersey and a student at Rutgers University. He was also president of the Lesbian Gay Student Alliance at Rutgers, and he wrote in a public article stating he was a homosexual. The Boy Scout officials read this interview, and they said, "Sorry, we don't want you to be an assistant scoutmaster anymore. You're out. We don't want you actually going on camping trips, sleeping in tents with young boys." And James Dale sued the Boy Scouts of America for discrimination. And he said, "The Boy Scouts are a public accommodation, like a hotel. And you can't just kick me out because I'm a homosexual." And it went to court, and James Dale won at the New Jersey Supreme Court. But then it was appealed to the United States Supreme Court, and by a 5-4 decision, I think rightly, unfortunately, the Supreme Court in 2000 said the Boy Scouts have a right to freedom of association, and especially because they have a message, and they had in their documentation that they had a message to proclaim, and part of the message was they were opposed to homosexual conduct as morally wrong. And if the Boy Scouts were forced to include homosexual scoutmasters, it would dilute that message. The freedom of association means the freedom to choose not to associate with people who disagree with your message. And so, Boy Scouts, you are okay not hiring James Dale as a homosexual. But that was one vote. That was within one vote. Four justices of the Supreme Court. Four justices of the Supreme Court decided that they thought the government could force people to hire someone that they didn't want to hire because of the person's homosexual conduct. And four justices on the Supreme Court thought that the Boy Scouts should be punished for refusing to hire someone because the person was a homosexual. Now, why would that decision have been troubling? It would have sent a legal precedent to be used against any Christian ministry that opens its doors to the public. Walkworthy Bookstore here at Scottsdale Bible Church could be forced to hire a practicing homosexual who applied and was otherwise qualified, I suppose. And some trends in other countries are quite troubling in this regard. February 8th, 2008, just under 2 years ago, in Cardiff, in Wales, in the United Kingdom, Margaret and I were in Cardiff last summer. In Cardiff, a government agency awarded £47,000, which was then about $94,000, to John Reaney, a homosexual man who had been turned down when he applied to be a youth pastor in a local church in the Church of England, and they turned him down. And the church was fined $94,000 for turning him down on the grounds of, they called it, turning him down, and they said it was wrongly discriminatory on the grounds of sexual orientation. Now what happens the next time a homosexual man applies? Are you going to pay another $94,000 and then another $94,000? Soon the church would be bankrupted. So what can it do? That's just 2 years ago, and that's England. Now my question is this. Did the founders of the United States and the original authors and signers of the Constitution, did they ever intend that the Supreme Court would have the right to decide for the entire nation what is appropriate and protected sexual conduct and what is not? Why should such a question of monumental significance to a nation be decided by 9 unelected judges, actually just by a majority of 5 unelected judges, rather than by the people as a whole through their elected representatives? You see, the very fact that citizens of the United States now just assume the Supreme Court can decide such things means we've long since abandoned the essence of the nation as it was founded. That is, the right of the people as a whole, through the democratic process and through their elected representatives, to decide the most important issues facing the nation. That question of whether people can decide not to have a homosexual scoutmaster or a homosexual youth pastor, that question, whether that should be legal or not, in a democracy, that should be decided by the people as a whole, not by 9 people that we've never voted for, have never been elected, have no accountability to the people. The majority, Rehnquist, O'Connor, Scalia, Kennedy, and Thomas, voted to go side with the Boy Scouts on this. The minority, Stevens, Souter, Ginsburg, and Breyer, four, voted that they should impose the requirement to hire that homosexual scoutmaster on the Boy Scouts. That was scary. Now there's something else that has happened. This idea that judges can see new things in the Constitution that were never there has spread to state courts as well, and state Supreme Courts as well. So in Massachusetts in 2003, the state Supreme Court, it's the Supreme Judicial Court or something, the name, in Massachusetts, by 4-3, look at this, decided in Goodridge v. Department of Public Health, decreed that Massachusetts had to allow same-sex marriage. What was their basis? The Constitution of Massachusetts. Who wrote the Constitution of Massachusetts? John Adams, one of the founding fathers of the United States, second president of the United States. Would John Adams ever have thought that he was writing words that would require same-sex marriage? Preposterous. It had nothing to do with the original meaning of the Constitution of the state of Massachusetts. That was written before the Constitution of the United States and was a pattern for the Constitution of the United States. But all of a sudden, by 4-3, the judges on the Supreme Court in Massachusetts found a right to same-sex marriage there. And so then it became the law of Massachusetts. What happened in Iowa? In the case Varnum v. Bryan, 2009, last year, the Supreme Court of Iowa found that Iowa had to allow same-sex marriage, had to allow 2 men to get married or 2 women to get married. Now, you may agree with that or you may disagree with that, but the point is the citizens of Massachusetts never decided this. The citizens of Iowa never decided this. It's just that their state Supreme Courts imposed it on them, following this procedure of finding new things that they called interpretations, but were never part of the original meaning of what the Constitution was. And then there was another case, very troubling one, in the United States Supreme Court. And that is, in 1992, the citizens of the state of Colorado, by 53.4% in 1992, the citizens of the state of Colorado passed an amendment to the Constitution saying that we will not have any laws in Colorado that give special protection to homosexual, lesbian, or sexual orientation, conduct, practices, or relationships, or that entitles such persons to have a claim to any minority status, quota preferences, protected status, or claim of discrimination. Now, what that meant was that homosexuals were just like everybody else in Colorado. They were protected by all the other laws in Colorado. It wasn't taking away any rights that anybody else had. It was just saying, we're not going to make them a special protected class to force you to hire them if they apply and are qualified. And so that kind of law is important, at least the citizens of Colorado by 53.4% thought it was important. Were you there? Did you live in Colorado at the time, Jack and Pammy? Yeah, okay.
Mr. Perkins, he did amendment two,
yeah.
And he was a godly guy.
Yeah. Okay.
And it wasn't that it was just that they would be just like everybody
yep.
else, so
yep.
businesses wouldn't have to hire.
Yep. So, I mean, here's the kind of thing that will happen. Recently in New Mexico, Elaine Huguenin had a photography studio. A lesbian couple came and asked her to take pictures for their quote marriage ceremony. She said, "No, I'd rather not do that." They sued her. And they've had to pay nearly $7,000 in attorney's fees now, even though same-sex marriage isn't even legal in New Mexico, and the Alliance Defense Fund is trying to protect her. But you can be forced to do something that violates your conscience when homosexuals become a protected class. Or Ocean Grove Camp Meeting Association, United Methodist Church in New Jersey, decided it would not rent its facilities to a lesbian couple for a civil union ceremony. The lesbians filed a complaint, and they had to go to court to defend this. I'm not sure if that one has been resolved yet. But see, churches being forced to rent their facilities for same-sex marriages. That's what happens when homosexuals become a special or protected class. So the citizens of Colorado amended their constitution, said, we're not going to do this. We're not going to, and Denver and Boulder, and you can't, your laws making this protected class of homosexuals, your laws are invalid. Then they appealed to the Supreme Court in the case Romer v. Evans. And what happened, the Supreme Court overruled the amendment to the constitution by the citizens of Colorado, which just shows you that the Supreme Court just won't let us do what we want to as citizens or what the majority of citizens think is right. They'll just overrule it. So Romer v. Evans in the Supreme Court, by 6-3 majority, overturned that amendment in 1996. More troubling was the reasoning that the court used. Now remember that many of the supporters of this amendment in Colorado had been Christians who held to traditional moral values regarding sexual conduct. And Pammy and Jack, you were there. You're saying that was Christians who supported that amendment. They weren't trying to harm homosexuals in any way. The homosexuals still had all the same privileges and rights that everybody else had in terms of the laws of Colorado, but they just weren't going to be a special class. But Justice Kennedy, in writing the majority opinion, said that this amendment to the Colorado Constitution, quote, lacks a rational relationship to legitimate state interests. In other words, the traditional moral standards, to say nothing of Christian moral values that people voted on, those traditional moral standards, those Christian values, lack a rational relationship to legitimate state interests. Did the Constitution of the United States or its authors or signers ever intend that traditional moral values should be excluded as a basis for state laws? No. Did the Constitution of the United States ever guarantee that homosexuals would be considered a special class and given special privileges and protections under the law? No. These are new policies imposed on the nation by the six justices of the Supreme Court. Not surprisingly, Justice Scalia, joined by Rehnquist and Thomas, strongly dissented. Justice Scalia wrote, "Since the Constitution of the United States says nothing about this subject, it is best left to be resolved by normal democratic means, including the democratic adoption of provisions in the state constitutions. I think it no business of the courts to take sides in this culture war." But today the court has done so, not only by inventing a novel and extravagant constitutional doctrine to take the victory away from traditional forces, but even by verbally disparaging as bigotry adherence to traditional values. And then Justice Scalia said, "Today's opinion has no foundation in American constitutional law and barely pretends to. The people of Colorado have adapted an entirely reasonable provision which doesn't even disfavor homosexuals in any substantive sense, merely denies them preferential treatment. Amendment 2 is designed to prevent piecemeal deterioration of the sexual morality favored by a majority of Coloradans. Striking it down is an act not of judicial judgment, but of political will. I dissent." But the Supreme Court decision was 6-3, and it was now the law of the land. And because of the power of the Supreme Court, there was nothing that any citizen or any majority of citizens in any state or any majority of citizens in the entire nation could do to change it. The issue was decided, not by the people of the United States, but by the court. Other cases, including capital punishment. It's interesting that, and this is on your outline, point 2F. In 1972 until 1976, the Supreme Court outlawed all capital punishment in the United States. And then it kind of undid its decision, and now capital punishment is allowed again. But think about that. It outlawed all capital punishment in the United States, saying it was cruel and unusual punishment. We say, well, wait a minute, did the original authors of the Constitution intend that? No, they didn't, because they even assume capital punishment in some of the things they say. The Fifth Amendment says, "Nor shall any person be subject for the same offense to be twice put in jeopardy of life or limb." To be put in jeopardy of life means you're assuming that there's capital punishment. And the Fifth Amendment says, "Indictment of a grand jury in a capital crime has certain requirements." Capital crime means a crime subject to capital punishment. That is the death penalty. So the Constitution assumes the death penalty, but the Supreme Court said in 1972, the Constitution forbids the death penalty. Did the authors of the Constitution forbid the death penalty? No. Did they intend to forbid the death penalty? No. The justices just invented a new meaning of cruel and unusual punishment, meaning contrary to the sense that was intended at the time the Constitution was adopted, contrary to the original meaning. And in fact, now that was undone, but in 2008, Kennedy v. Louisiana, the Supreme Court prohibited the death penalty now for any crime against an individual where the victim's life was not taken. It was a horrible, horrible, brutal rape and violent assault, repeated rape and violent assault against a very young girl by a just physically very huge, strong man. And Louisiana imposed the death penalty, and the Supreme Court said you can't do that. Now, you may or may not think the death penalty is appropriate in such case, but my point is that shouldn't be for the Supreme Court to decide. That should be for the citizens of each state, by their elected representatives, to decide when and when not to have a death penalty. It's important to realize how broad the powers of the court have now become. All the important legal issues of our time are now decided by a small group of 9 judges, none of whom has ever been elected by any group of voters in the United States, and none of whom is accountable to any group of voters in the entire United States. They are unelected, they are unaccountable, and they decide nearly all the important issues of our nation today. Is this the kind of government that we want to have? Is this really what a democracy is supposed to be? Is this how our nation was set up to function? Certainly not. But right now, the citizens of the United States have absolutely no power to overcome those rulings. And I've talked about that. Ed?
Can't you have new trials or procedures within the Supreme Court that would, for instance, Roe versus Wade? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Isn't that the only way that a Supreme Court decision can be changed?
Yeah, the Supreme Court decision can be changed if different justices are put on the court and they overrule a previous ruling. And in fact, it happened last Thursday. The Supreme Court, by 5-4 again, overruled this campaign finance restriction law, McCain-Feingold. And so they actually reversed what they had done. And if enough justices who want to reverse Roe v. Wade were on the court, then a challenge could be brought through some case, and they could reverse it. They could reverse all of these things. But it would take justice, a sufficient number of justices who say, we are not going to make laws. We're just going to rule according to the original sense of the Constitution. And those are called originalists, or that view is called originalism. And four justices on the Supreme Court now hold that view: Roberts, Thomas, Scalia, and Alito.
And the only way we can do that is by electing people who are going to appoint.
Yep. So how do we get justices on the Supreme Court? The president appoints and the Senate confirms. So the way we do that is by electing people who will appoint originalist justices to the Supreme Court. Yeah. Okay, I'm coming to this. Okay, now, point three. I'm going to preface this by saying, Pastor Jamie, the elders of Scottsdale Bible Church, the people who are in charge of the enrichment classes said they'd be happy to have me teach this class, but I said at the beginning, you're free to disagree with me. Political issues are not as clear as the deity of Christ or salvation by faith alone or the doctrine of the Trinity. I'm kind of reasoning from patterns of how the nation of Israel was governed and things like that. You might differ with me, all right? You're free to do that. So I'm just saying that. This is not the official teaching of Scottsdale Bible Church. This is Wayne Grudem's own opinion, and I'm trying to persuade you, and I happen to have the microphone. But here is an area in which there is a difference between what is traditionally called more liberal or more conservative views of politics. And the two parties in the United States, the Republicans and the Democrats, have by and large come down on different sides of this issue. And so I want to explain how that is happening. When all this power was being usurped by the Supreme Court, why didn't the system of checks and balances correct it? Why didn't the president, the executive branch, and the legislative branch, the Congress, why didn't they step in and appoint new justices who wouldn't carry on all this fancy interpretation, inventing things that were never there in the first place? Well, the answer is that many liberal politicians in the other two branches began to realize the goals they had for remaking the United States could be accomplished simply through the rulings of the courts. For many liberal politicians, they were delighted at Roe v. Wade that legalized abortion in the United States. This was a much quicker and easier solution than trying to persuade each of the 50 legislatures in the 50 states and 50 governors to overturn their laws restricting or prohibiting abortions. Therefore, rather than acting as a check and balance against the Supreme Court, many in Congress decided they would support the court's usurpation of power. And they would support judges at the federal district level and the appeals court level who would uphold this judicial activism. And more liberal presidents, such as President Clinton, appointed justices to the Supreme Court, such as Ginsburg and Breyer, who would promote this judicial activism. So influential members of the other two branches, legislative and executive branches, joined with and supported the Supreme Court in its wrongful usurpation of powers. Once that happened, the system of checks and balances in our nation was broken. It seems to me that this is the most serious flaw in the whole system of government in the United States today. So I started out with this chapter. Once we got to specific issues, it seems to me it's the greatest problem facing America today is that the system is broken. And laws are no longer ultimately made by the legislatures and the people. So a number of politicians began to attempt to take over the means of selecting Supreme Court justices and judges for the lower courts. This process came to clear focus in a national controversy over President Reagan's nomination of Robert Bork as a Supreme Court justice in 1987, 23 years ago. Robert Bork had been a highly respected judge in the most influential appeals court in the United States, except for the Supreme Court, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit. He had also served as Solicitor General of the United States. That's the lawyer who represents the government of the United States before the Supreme Court. He also was professor at Yale Law School. He had been called by many people the most able constitutional living constitutional scholar in the United States. But many liberal senators, led by the late Senator Ted Kennedy of Massachusetts, strongly opposed Bork's nomination. Bork was an originalist in terms of interpretation. And these senators realized if Bork's nomination were confirmed, a majority on the Supreme Court would oppose the Roe v. Wade decision regarding abortion and would probably overturn that decision. Within 45 minutes of Bork's nomination, Ted Kennedy issued a strong condemnation of Bork in a nationally televised speech on the floor of the Senate. Senator Joe Biden was head of the Senate Judiciary Committee at that time, and he, with Senator Kennedy, led the opposition to Bork. Southern Democrats, conservative Southern Democratic senators eventually turned against Bork, and the nomination was rejected by 58 to 42. Eventually, the vacant seat, Reagan submitted another nominee that he knew could get through, and that was filled by Anthony Kennedy. That single vote in the United States Senate, it seems to me, tragically changed the course of history in the United States for decades to come. Now, Robert Bork in 1990, 3 years after that, published a best-selling book called The Tempting of America, The Political Seduction of the Law. It's an excellent book. Here, Robert Bork, The Tempting of America. And he articulates what is at stake. He's sitting back and saying, this is a bigger thing than just my nomination. It's the control of the whole culture and the whole society that's at stake. And so I want to read a longer quote from this. Just a second. In the past few decades, American institutions have struggled with the temptations of politics. Professions and academic disciplines that once possessed a life of their own have steadily succumbed to the belief that nothing matters beyond politically desirable results, however achieved. Politics inevitably tries to dominate another discipline, to use it for politics' own purposes, whether law, religion, literature, economics, science, journalism, or whatever. It is coming to be denied that anything counts, not logic, not objectivity, not even intellectual honesty, that stands in way of the, quote, correct political outcome. The process by which this is accomplished may vary from field to field. Some of you who have been to university recently know that you might take a literature course, but it becomes a politics course. You might take a science course that even becomes a politics course, because everything is used to political ends. An anthropology course, a sociology course, whatever. Bork says in the law, this is what happens. In law, the moment of temptation, now his book is called The Tempting of America, and he says, here's when judges are tempted. The moment of temptation is the moment of choice when a judge realizes that in the case before him, his strongly held view of justice, his political and moral imperative, is not embodied in a statute or in any provision of the Constitution. That's a judge who thinks we have to let women have a right to abortion, but there's no law and there's nothing in the Constitution that says that. But I know that this is right. I have to make it happen. See, that's the temptation, Bork is saying. And in that moment, the judge must then choose between his version of justice and abiding by the American form of government. And Bork says, to give in to temptation this one time solves an urgent human problem, and a faint crack appears in the American foundation. A judge has begun to rule where a legislator should. You go back to that Kelo case versus City of New London. The judges are saying, this is good. New London, it has this slum area. It's all run down. We need to get it developed. But there's nothing that says that we can take private property for private use. But let's make it happen anyway. Private use means, public use means public good. And even if it's private property, a crack appears in the American foundation. A judge has begun to rule where a legislator should in all these cases. So Bork says, the clash over my nomination was simply one battle in the long-running war for control of our legal culture. In the larger war for control of the law, there are only two sides. Either the Constitution and the statutes are law, which means that their principles are known and control judges, or they are malleable texts that judges may rewrite to see that political groups or political causes win. The Constitution is the highest prize, and control of the selection of judges is the last step on the path to that prize. Why? Because the Constitution is the trump card in American politics, and judges decide what the Constitution means. When the Supreme Court invokes the Constitution, whether legitimately or not, as to that issue, the democratic process is at an end. How, then, can this be solved? Bork says, if judges are unelected, unaccountable, and unrepresentative, as they must be to perform their vital role, who is to protect us from the power of judges? How are we to be guarded from our guardians? The answer can only be that judges must consider themselves bound by law that is independent of their own views of the desirable. What does it mean to say that a judge is bound by law? It means that he is bound by the only thing that can be called law, the principles of the text, whether constitution or statute, as generally understood at the enactment. That's called originalism. You rule according to the original meaning or sense of the words. And then he goes on to say, every departure from original understanding is an item on the modern liberal agenda. Abolition of the death penalty, protection of homosexual conduct as valid, other things he lists. Well, at the time of the enactment of Roe v. Wade, there was only one originalist on the Supreme Court, and that was Justice Rehnquist. Now there are four. And let's see. Here's the Supreme Court now. The originalists who want to rule according to the original meaning of the Constitution say these are for the Congress and the states to decide. Roberts, the Chief Justice, Scalia, who is 73, Clarence Thomas, who is 61, and Justice Alito, recently appointed. Usually liberal judges or justices who will take what I think is an invalid procedure of inventing new laws and saying their interpretations. Stevens, who is 89, turns 90 this year. Ginsburg, 76, Sotomayor, and Breyer. So a number of older justices here. And the swing vote, who goes one way or the other, is Anthony Kennedy, who was nominated instead of Bork. Democrats and Republicans differ strongly over this issue. And it doesn't only affect the United States Supreme Court, it affects state courts. Remember Iowa Supreme Court imposing homosexual conduct or marriage on the state. Massachusetts Supreme Court imposing homosexual conduct on Massachusetts by one vote. In individual states, and I think I'm trying to state fact here with just saying this is what is happening. Democratic governors appoint state Supreme Court justices who hold this activist view of the power of the courts. On a national level, Democratic candidates for president and Democratic members of the Senate have done everything they can to protect and preserve this process of new court-made law by opposing most originals who are nominated to the Supreme Court or to the lower courts. Conservatives, on the other hand, most Republican governors in states and most Republican candidates for president and Republican senators, most but not all, have supported originalist candidates for judicial opinions. Though Justice Stevens was appointed by Gerald Ford. However, Justice Stevens had a reputation as quite a conservative judge when he was appointed, or a moderately conservative judge, but he now consistently sides with the liberal or activist wing. Now people say, what's wrong with our nation? Why do we allow abortions? Why do we have homosexuality and homosexual marriage? Why do we have removal of religion from public events and public places? Why do we have people saying we shouldn't have religious convictions influencing public actions? Why do we have the removal of schools of teaching accountability to God for actions or teaching any absolute moral standards and moral erosion in society? Why do we have the undermining of personal sexual morality through the nullification of all but the most mild restraints on pornography? Why do we have the promotion of international law to interpret the Constitution? This all goes back to Supreme Court decisions. This is why the election every 4 years of a president and the election of U.S. senators are going to decide the direction of the Supreme Court and the direction that our nation will take in this most crucial issue. We now live in anything but a democracy. This is anything but the constitutional republic that was given to us by our founding fathers. This is anything but what our forefathers fought and died to establish for us. This is anything but a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. This is a system, this is a government effectively ruled by 9 justices. And in fact, because it's divided 4-4, it's a government now effectively ruled by one man, Anthony Kennedy, who has never been elected. It's a system gone horribly wrong. The Supreme Court takes only about 80 cases a year out of 6,000 that are appealed to it. So the lower courts have great influence as well. And so the appointment by the president of district and appeals court justices is also extremely important. And that's why when President Bush left office, there were 10 nominees for appeals court positions and 17 nominees for district court positions who had been given even no hearings in the Senate. Because Patrick Leahy of Vermont just refused to give them even hearings, and they waited for over 2 years even to get a vote because he didn't want more originalists into the system who would then begin to affect the legal climate in the country. Is this a biblical question? It seems to me that a Christian worldview should lead us to support judges who rule according to the original intent. Number one, because Romans 13 tells us, let every person be subject to the governing authorities. And to my mind, the highest governing authority in our nation is the United States Constitution. And to Romans 13, to be subject to the Constitution means following its original meaning in what it said. There's another biblical value, and that is the wisdom of having separation of powers to guard against the abuse of power, which is true in the way God has established governments in various areas throughout the Bible. Another item is that people should be accountable for their actions, and it's wrong for judges who judge the laws to also be the people who make the law. We have that. And then any Christian can look at the anti-Christian results in an area such as the exclusion of God from the public square and the erosion of moral standards, etc., and say there's something gone wrong here from an activist judiciary. How can we affect this? Practically, it seems to me, by voting. And I'm going to argue here that, in one sense, every vote for every candidate at the national and local level affects this, because people elected to the Arizona legislature at the local level eventually become governors, or they become senators, or they become president. And people appointed through the judiciary at the local level sometimes get on state Supreme Courts and then make these decisions. And so at that level, people can say, well, I'll just look at the candidate. It doesn't matter which party the candidate belongs to. I'll vote for one or the other. But the parties are just strongly divided in this view of what the judges should do. And so your vote for a Republican or a Democratic candidate does affect the direction of the nation in this area. Now, that's probably the most controversial thing I'm going to say over 50 weeks of teaching this class. But it does seem to me that it's an important issue. Now, we have a few minutes. In fact, we have probably 5 or 8 or 10. John, go ahead. Good to see you back here. I see a lot of people. I see Gunter back here in a minute, too.
Sitting here listening to this, you go back to the Old Testament, and you look at the Ten Commandments that God gave Israel. And then man took those Ten Commandments, and his Pharisees made 700 rules, adding to them.
Mm-hmm.
You take our Constitution,
mm-hmm.
which at the time it was written, law, and I'd like an attorney that's somewhere in this room that can answer this. Law wasn't what it is today. It was ruled by the Blackstone Law, which was basically a black and white book of definitive
interpreting
right,
words
right.
according
and so,
to the original meaning.
And then, I don't know when this switched, but then the courts went to, okay, that's not going to be in effect anymore. We're just going to take decisions, and then once that decision made, all of the court cases from here on out are based on that decision. If they had kept Blackstone, and if they kept if the Constitution was honored, the judges couldn't do what they're doing.
Yeah.
Because they'd have governing book that says this is right,
yep.
this is law.
Yeah. Yep. So there's an evolution of the legal
now
process.
Now we have evolutionary law, so it can go from white to black by the time the judges get through it.
I don't have the information to give you the history of that, John, but there was a shift in what law meant. But it was because people wanted to get a certain result, and they figured, we can do it this way.
But does that make sense,
what
I'm asking or saying?
Yep.
To find
my,
an attorney.
My amateur mind, yes.
Find a practicing attorney and see if they'll answer that.
Good. Gunter, I saw your hand next. Gunter, back there. Oh, we got to see a lot of hands here, so.
I'd like to make a quick comment before my questions.
Yep.
Watch your children. You mentioned the politicization of classes.
Yes.
I had the dubious privilege of being raised part of my life in East Germany. When I went to college here, back in the 60s, I recognized the same thing being taught in colleges that I read in East German books.
In the communist literature
that's
in
right.
East Germany.
That's right. So that's just a comment. Watch what your children learn.
Yep.
But my question is, from what I know, the founders were concerned with the dictatorship of the majority, which has resulted in a dictatorship of the Supreme Court. I don't have an answer to it, but do you... How can we resolve the?
Yeah, their answer was that the Constitution prevents even a foolish majority from changing the system of government. It's supposed to do that. And honestly, I think I have hope that it still will do that because there is a process yet to change the Supreme Court. So that's my hope. Now, look, boy, you're bringing the microphone. I'll go way over here, way in the back. I'm just going to skip around. Okay, what's your name?
Steve Swager.
Steve.
And haven't the states that passed same-sex marriage have overturned basically what the Supreme Court has said? You know, didn't California come along and say that, you know, you can't have same-sex marriage anymore in this state? And so did Maine, I thought.
Yeah. Well, the courts in the state in those states, because the government of the United States... There's an assumption that individual states determine what is marriage and what is not. Like you can get married at different ages in different states. If you're in, I'm not going to slander certain southern states, but but you can get married at a younger age in some states than others. Let's just say that. So marriage law has been a state thing. Those Supreme Court, once the Supreme Court in the state rules, then it's done unless the citizens overturn it through a constitutional amendment for the state constitution. That's what happened with Proposition 8 in California. And now liberals have brought a trial against Proposition 8 that's going on right now in California saying this is violating the United States Constitution because it's wrongful discrimination. So they're trying to overturn what the citizens of California did, just like people are trying to overturn, or tried to overturn and did overturn what the citizens of Colorado did. So there's a lot of turmoil right now. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Boy. Alan, Scott, I don't know. I'm just trying to get around as quick as we can.
Wayne, I can't help but trying to end this with something very positive. I think that last Tuesday night, a fresh wind started blowing from Massachusetts, and no one would have guessed that. Now, hopefully you won't have to change your book, because everything that you have said was true, but I just have a lot more hope after last Tuesday night.
Now, look, Alan, I'm going to protect your freedom to say that, and I'll tell you afterward what I think, I want to be careful because I realize that there are people in the class who have different views and who would be Republicans or Democrats. I'm saying on this specific issue, the parties are different, but I really want people who have different views to be able to feel free to express their view as well as yours. So that's why I'm not going to clap or cheer. Okay. Just because I don't want to turn this into a one-sided. Okay, even though I did come down very strongly on one side on this issue. Okay, thanks. What's your name?
Yeah, the lower courts of the United States are creations of Congress, mm-hmm. and could be uncreated by Congress
if
and
there
reorganized.
Was the will in Congress to do
right.
that.
And also we bemoan the politicization of the university, but yet we fund the universities.
Yep.
It seems to me that we have actually big sticks to use against both the courts and the universities. We've refused to act.
Well, or it takes an immense amount of effort to make changes. Some states have tried to change what is being taught in the universities, but the faculty fight back. And so it's good to be involved. And do what you can at every level. Okay, who else just really wants to say something? What's your name back here?
My name is Matthew Kramer.
Matthew.
I just have a question for you, Dr. Grudem. I agree with you that Supreme Court justices should be chosen on the basis of the fact that they're originalist interpreters. But I guess I was trying to think that maybe the opposition to that is that there are instances in our nation's history where the law hasn't been good.
Yep.
And for instance, the clear and obvious case is the laws regarding slavery.
Yep.
And is that pretty much kind of the parallel that everyone draws to, like, concerning, you know, homosexuality and stuff, where, you know, they say, well, here's a clear-cut case where, with slavery, where the law, you know, gave rights to own
right.
slaves.
But slavery was overturned not by the United States Supreme Court saying you can't any longer hold slaves, but by Congress passing laws and by amendments being passed to the Constitution. That is how it's supposed to work in a
right.
democracy. So right. that is what should happen.
Right, but, you know, would you be in favor of an originalist interpretation of the Constitution, say, in the late 1700s, early 1800s, when slavery was legal, and, you know...
I'm in favor of originalist interpretation of the Constitution, always. And the way to change something that's wrong is get the votes mm-hmm. to change it.
So the justices are, you know, judging in those cases, made the right decisions... Even when they had a law...
When they may have differed with it.
Right.
That's not the judge's
right.
role
yeah.
to impose his own ideas of what the country should have for laws or constitution.
I agree, but
okay.
you know, I think that that's the opposition to it. You know, there's
good.
Yeah.
Thanks. I wish we'd go on longer talking, but it's time to end. I have to end. I'm sorry. But I did want to say I did write that friend of the court brief for the Supreme Court. In the case Christian Legal Society versus Hastings College or versus Martinez, Hastings College of Law, it has been signed by I think 23 former presidents of the Evangelical Theological Society now, and it'll be filed with the Supreme Court I think February 2nd. So thank you for your prayers on that. The Lord directed I think 5 different lawyers looked over it and made appropriate revisions. And so that's going forward. Oh, I wish I could just have more time to call on more of you. I'm sorry. We will come back next week. I'll tell you what, if you have something urgent that you wanted to say on this, I'll give 5 or 10 minutes at the beginning of class next hour if you'd like to. If you want to differ with me, that's fine. I want you to feel freedom to do that. Let me just pray. Father, thank you for the freedom to stand here and differ with things that have happened in our government and not fear being put in jail or arrested. Thank you that we live in a country where people are still elected. Thank you for the freedoms that you've given us and for many good things that happen in our nation. Thank you for the teachings of your word and the principles of the supremacy of law above judges. We pray for the good of our nation and that you would guide us as a population and our elected leaders, including President Obama and the justices of the Supreme Court and the members of Congress, to make wise decisions and decisions that would be pleasing to you. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.